And welcome to episode 46 of Jughead's Basement. Right now, you are listening to the song Feed the Dry from Gubscott Conway's band, Gage. During the recording of this episode, the world was combating a pandemic, and the states were just about to engage in a series of protests that would quickly and justifiably spread throughout the whole country. This interview with Gubscott Conway and Todd Pott has been lifted from a live show I hosted called Live Quarantine Hour with Jughead, Bill, and William. Therefore, there are many sound and internet challenges that make these streams difficult to edit for the audio podcast, but I have decided to highly edit and release some of them over the next couple months, so a little context may help. I was contacted via email by Bill of Siren Records in McHenry, Illinois. He wanted to send me some records. I received a shit ton of great merchandise and recordings. It was amazing and very generous. We contacted each other again and decided to fill some of our quarantine time with creating a live show for people to watch and listen to while stuck in their homes. They are also to engage with us live by writing in the chat, and that is why we reference listeners during the show. We were trying to help them to reform a punk community online, to fill the gap as best we could for musicians and fans that were, and for the most part, as I write this now, unable to perform live. Many artists have come up with creative ways to deal with this dilemma, and the quarantine hour was our solution. These interviews are less interviews and more friends hanging out. Early on, Bill's son, William, joined in and quickly became an important part of our show. He's a good kid, and it seemed a great way to give him something to do while quarantined, to learn more about his father's lifelong passion for punk music. So in this context, I now bring you Gubscott Conway of Even and Blackouts, Ivy League, Ghost Forest, and the highly influential band Gage, which helped to inspire a generation of emo bands around the world. And we also have Todd Pott in his home, in his lava-lit tub, eating cherries. Todd was the vocalist and lyricist for Apocalypse Hoboken, and also the house that Gloria Vander built, among many others. He's an incredible intellect, and I was happy to talk to him during this conversation. This conversation was far-reaching. And this particular episode took off amongst my Facebook friends and is still the most watched episode of all the live quarantine hours. The dialogue is funny, historical, and philosophical, talking about such things as the meaning of rebellion, emo music, talks of conflict between Apocalypse Hoboken and Screeching Weasel, and we discuss in length the Chicago punk scene in general. So let's begin! So we are now live. I'll just say the quick thing. We got Bill and William over there. William just graduated today from what, you are going to be a freshman, or you were a freshman graduate now?
I'm going to be a freshman.
Yeah, he's going to be a freshman. Is that a new school for you then, right? Yeah.
Yes.
Well, when we do go back to school, when people do go back to school, it will be a new school. And then we got Gub over here. And then we got Todd, who's in his bathtub, and he's got the lava lamp going. So am I the only one out of Illinois? You're all like in Chicago area now, right? So I'm the only one. Yes. In Japan? Only Japan member right now? Okay. Oh, look, we got some people in here already. James Angle. What's up, guys? He says. Mm-hmm. Joe says to put on a shirt, Todd. Joe Kletz. Oh, Paul Silver made it. Paul Silver didn't know if he was going to make it because he was driving. He had to go see his mom, I think. So, hey, Todd, do you know Paul too?
I don't know.
Oh yeah,
I know some Pauls. I don't know. Yeah, yeah. The last name doesn't ring a bell.
Gub, he was he ran a label that you were on, right? Is that correct?
He had a label called Radius Records, and we did our first full length split with THD, their label out of Minneapolis, and that's the Soothe full length that we did. He was going to put that out.
So, Gub, you were just getting into some the first. You actually have documentations of a lot of your shows with Gage and all the other bands. So you said you just offline. You just said the first one that you played with Todd here, right? What was it?
That was our Gage 99th show. That was September 18th. I believe that was 1993. 93 or 92. I didn't look at the exact page on it, but it was at a Turner's Hall, and Seam played with us and Apocalypse Hobo and Tommy Rot.
That's right.
Yeah, that was our 99th show.
Seam headlined that
show.
And
the date and the year.
How are you guys with like remembering shows? If like you were to rattle off a bunch of those, Todd, are you have a good memory for like old shows you've played? I don't. I can't. It's hard for me to remember places and venues and years.
I don't remember a lot of local shows, but I can remember a lot of shows on tour for some reason.
What's your most memorable tour show or memory?
Reno, Nevada sticks out. We've had a lot. The Warp Tour shows stick out. Because they were so incredibly terrible, but there's a lot.
What's up with Nevada? I know. I just remember touring in those that part of the country was always pretty difficult in a van with no air conditioning or your engine's about to overheat all the time.
There's a bar called Peyton's Place in Nevada. I don't know if it's there anymore. There's a swingers bar there. We pulled into town and I believe we had an off night. We didn't have anything to do. So we were walking around town and ended up in this bar called Peyton's Place. And there was this guy in there from Chicago. And he's like, you guys should stick around here till later on. And long story short, the whole band ended up leaving, but I stayed. And throughout the night, more and more people started filtering in and ended up being a swingers bar. And I partook in a lot of festivities in the bar. it sticks out as an eventful night.
Nevada memories.
I go into depth. They had bathtubs there too.
That might actually lead into one of the questions William and I were kind of talking about earlier was, and this is actually for like the three of you guys. What's like the most outrageous, craziest thing you guys have seen while you've been on stage? Like what's just made you stop dead in your tracks and go, holy shit, what was that going on?
Let's throw this one. Gubs, you got something for us? And just try to give each other time to speak.
Oh my God. There's so many shows just off the top of my head right now, just talking about Reno, Nevada, which is definitely a crazy town. pretty crazy show. Cause back in the day, you know, it wasn't just like punk bands were just playing with punk bands. There's different kinds of bands playing metal bands or, you know, you get different kinds of music playing at different shows. Well, we play the show in Reno at an abandoned casino and it was all like crusty punk band from England playing. I can't remember the bands. Chaos UK played. So, you know, Gage was kind of, you know, we weren't exactly that sound, but it was a very, very interesting show. And the aftermath, you know, ended up with, I believe the singer of Chaos UK slamming the door at Neil's face, not letting him stay where we're going to stay for the night. So I can't even, ABC Rio, always crazy shows there. I mean, the list goes down the line. There's so many crazy, crazy events that happen.
Yeah, I got a lot of crazy ones, but the you were just talking about playing with metal bands, and one of the first Screeching Weasel shows was at Batteries Not Included with a band called Funeral Bitch, and the bass player just used E-strings. He goes, you don't need anything more than E-strings, and his amp was so loud. It was just...
Play with a band in Baltimore. And I forgot the name of the band. I can't remember the name of the band right now. But they were a metal band. And the drummer, I kid you not, he must have been maybe like 100 pounds. But the longest arms and just pale white. And he's just like going crazy and smoking at the same time. And he just looked like a spider. He was like, what the hell is this guy doing?
There's a band out of New Jersey. I can't remember their name, but the drummer used to sit on just a regular chair, like a comfy chair. And we thought it was pretty funny. You might've been on that tour, Gub. I can't remember, but I asked him why he sits on a comfy chair and he like pulled down his pants a little bit and showed a big scar. He goes, well, one time I was drumming on a drum stool and the drum, you know, the cushion came off and the stool went up his ass. Like, and he had like surgery. Yeah. So he never sits on a drum stool anymore.
Learned his lesson.
You got any crazy what's your answer to that besides your Nevada story?
One that sticks out is I think it was the first tour that we went through Leave Home Booking. I don't know if you know Stormy Shepherd.
Yeah.
So this was the first tour that she did for us, and it was just a ramshackle bullshit tour. And one of the shows, she was stoked for us to play because she said, there's these kids, they're in a band called the Canker Sores, and they want you to come play this party. And we're like, oh, that sounds cool. It's a fucking, it's a party. We've been playing shitty shows. At least there'll be beer and, you know, place to sleep for the night, and should be cool. These kids, I guess, like us. Well, we show up and it was a party, but it was a party for, it was a seventh grade party. And, you know, we had been on the road now for like 2.5 weeks. And so it was kids between the ages of 8 and 11 were at this show. And none of them knew who we were. And there was no beer or anything. It was birthday cake and pizza. And we pull up out of the van. We all come barreling out of the van. And, you know, the mom runs up to the van. She's like, oh, we're so excited for you guys to, you know, be playing. And needless to say, it wasn't going to be a show for us to play, but it sticks into memory as being a potential nightmare.
we did a show with Screeching Weasel in South Carolina that was a kid's mother ran a daycare. So they turned the daycare into a punk show. So it wasn't actually for little kids, but it was punks all hanging out in this daycare. And she had it like bowls of M&M sitting out and all this, like, and all the punks were like riding on like big wheels. It was really crazy, and like little teeny slides. That was a crazy show.
It reminds me of do you remember the place called Tunnels of Fun that used to have shows? I forget which suburb it was in. But it was one of those it was like a giant habit trail. That was pretty weird and intense to play in, to see all these kids in these weird little tubes while you're playing. That's pretty cool. To do shows like that from now on, just put the kids in a habit trail.
I know, Gub, you were a suburban and a Chicago boy growing up, because you moved from one to the other and back again, or what was, I forgot, what's your story there?
I mean, I grew up on the east side of Chicago until I was about 10 years old. And then I moved to the western suburbs, lived there, and bounced around back and forth in between a lot as a kid, and spent a lot of time in the city on the north side, you know, started going to see shows probably when I was like 13. So like, you know, I won't date myself, but I started seeing shows like, you know, Black Flag at Metro and like, you know, that's kind of stuff when I was young. And grew up lived in the suburbs, lived in the city. Moved back to the city. I lived in San Francisco for a while. Yeah.
Todd, what was your, when you first started in the Apocalypse, was that your first sort of band that was playing out and recording, or were you in something before that one?
I had a high school band, but Hoboken. I used to go see Hoboken from eighth grade till all through high school and into college. And my second year of college is when I joined Hoboken. They were my favorite local band. I used to go see them at Dirty Nellies and McGregor's, and I was from the suburbs. I grew up in Hanover Park.
Hey, now we just given a little bit of a clue, but Bill, you have a record that you have there, right?
Yeah, I thought it'd be kind of fun to give another prize away. So
Gub, it's one of your record. You're on all the Gage records, right? Yeah. He couldn't find your name on that for some reason.
The reflection on it was throwing me off because I'm getting some kind of weird face on it, but now I know I see the color now. So it's Fire Tongues Burning Stomach. Yeah.
Yeah.
Great record. Yeah. So do you remember the recording of that record?
Oh, very much so. That was a good time. I was done in Wheaton at El Jordan. Actually, I think was it Journey or some other like 80s metal band was the famed band that recorded their hit song there or whatever. But the studio was amazing. I had a friend who was in a band called Mannequin Hand, which later turned into Son of Man. They're also on Shake Fork Records. He was an engineer, actually went to Columbia College, you and I, John, and he ended up engineering that album, Andy Koharik. Amazing, amazing space.
So we're going to give this record away to the first person who's, I'm going to say, how do I phrase this? All of our bands have played in a club earlier, but what is the like second earliest club where Todd was in Apocalypse Hoboken, Gub was in Gage, and I was in Screeching Weasel, that we all played in the same venue? If you can get that, you'll get the Bill will send you the record. So whoever's the first one to put that venue into the chat will get that. This is our first time giving something away, Bill.
You know, this way it is, because Jay won the contest against you.
Yeah, Jay, I don't know if anyone knows Jay from the Prozacs, but he actually knew more about Screeching Weasel than I did, so I wasn't surprised. Paul is the first one there, so Paul Silver gets the – Paul, do you have that record already? And do you still want it?
And Jake actually stumped on this one. He's like, I got nothing.
Jake, does Jake usually know – oh, Jay? He said.
Yeah.
Encyclopedia. Fireside, but we never really – it's kind of weird to me sometimes that some people don't – even they didn't go through it like we did, but they don't know that sort of a progression and timeline. About the Fireside of McGregor's, because Fireside, it was Brian Peterson started Gub, or Todd, or was
Brian Peterson started, if you want to talk about it. I know we played the second show there. Brian Peterson's band played the first show. I forgot the name of his damn band, but we played the second show at Fireside.
Right. So I forgot if Brian worked with Matt at McGregor's or no, or he just, I thought there was some sort of link between the two, but maybe not.
I thought Fireside had shows before Brian started booking them there. I thought, didn't Joey book the first show at Fireside before it really became the Fireside Bowl? Do you guys have any recollection of that?
You know, I remember vaguely there was like some shows bouncing in and out of there like randomly, but it really didn't become the Fireside Bowl. I think Brian had
right
shows. Yeah. He moved from Elgin, I believe, to Chicago and started doing shows here.
Ah, right. But, when I say Joe, I mean Joey Vindictive. He booked one of the first shows at Fireside. And then Brian, after booking an Elgin for a long time, took hold of it. And then it became Fireside Bowl that we all know and love.
Right.
Well, I didn't know Joey did that. You know, you go back and there's some of these people that just didn't get the amount of credit of things that they did to help start stuff. And Joey was one of those. He was always starting whether the record store or venues to start booking stuff. Even before Weasel was a band, he was in Victims of Society, right? Yeah. Yeah. I think he precedes all of us probably.
He,
absolutely.
Jawbreaker, I believe in Chicago. He had his record store, but next door was that abandoned church. And he put on a show in there before it burned down, I believe.
Oh, by the way, people are still asking who got it, but Paul was the first one that said it was McGregor's. Was the first one that all three of our bands played together. While if you were to say before Todd's time, then Apocalypse Hoboken played at Dirty Nelly's quite a lot. But Todd's days started at McGregor's. So. And Gage, Gage around at Dirty Nelly's days? Ivy League was, I know.
And Ivy League was, I don't think Ivy League actually ever played Dirty Nelly's. I saw a lot of shows at Dirty Nelly's, but I don't think I actually ever played Dirty Nelly's.
Wow, I didn't even, that wouldn't have been the answer anyway. So maybe McGregor's is the first one. I don't know my own trivia answers.
Possibly.
I'm just surprised that Ivy League never played there because, you know, you were on, I guess my timeline is, but Octung Chicago, which Bill has in the record store there, all of our bands are on that one, but that was precedes you, Todd, on that, I think.
Yeah, that's with Ted on vocals.
Yeah.
For that Octung thing, we actually did, we all did a show, John, if you remember, at the Gateway Theater. It was like Weasel, Ivy League, and pretty much all the bands that were on that compilation did a live show at the Gateway Theater, which is now the Polish Copernicus Center, I believe, on Lawrence.
Oh, yeah, that's right near my house. Yeah, right by my house on the corner there.
Yeah.
Now, I want to get this history straight now. What led you to taking over as the vocalist for Apocalypse Hoboken?
I found a flyer at a record store called Turntable. When Turntable used to be in Schaumburg, and then they moved to Palatine. And in the Palatine store, there was a flyer. I still have it, in fact, of Apocalypse Hoboken looking for a singer for a band in the vein of All and Dag Nasty. And it had the three phone numbers of Andy, Bill, and I think Kurt. I called each number. I had lyrics, just a notebook filled of lyrics. They had me come and try out. And from then on out, I was the singer. I wanted to be in that band from the moment I heard them. So it was joining my favorite band.
Other than like covers, Todd, do you normally sing your own lyrics, or are you okay with singing in other band members' lyrics, or how do you work that way?
Well, in terms of Hoboken, we barely did any of the older songs.
Yeah.
We did like four or five of the songs that I didn't do. And I write all the lyrics. I have no problem doing covers. But when it comes to songs, I write my own lyrics. But like I said, I don't have any issues singing someone else's words.
I'm curious about that because Weasel was in the early days was pretty straightforward that Ben was going to be the lyricist. I tried writing some stuff, but I didn't like putting words in his mouth because we had such different feelings about life. So I just didn't know whether how you felt about like that, if it was harder for you to sing other people's songs.
I was in a band called Mexican Cheerleader before Pete ended up singing for them. The band originally was going to be me singing, Pete just playing bass, and then Andy on drums and Scott on guitar. Pete wrote all the music and all the words. And he also dictated how the songs were going to be sung. That's something that my voice is my instrument, I felt like I wasn't offering anything. And Pete had this vision, this particular vision of how he wanted things to go. And he heard my voice singing his melodies and his lyrics. And it just didn't work out with me doing it because I didn't feel like I was giving anything to it, if that makes any sense.
I definitely think you aren't saying you're incapable of that, but it seems some situations call for, it's harder for you to take on. I can understand that too. With Ben, I was like, that's fine. No big deal. Gub, you're
right.
You've always been guitarist along with both. Were you ever just a vocalist in the band?
You know what? Think of it. I've never been just a vocalist. I've always played guitar and sang or sang backups. Never did just a straight me singing.
Todd, did you ever play an instrument in a band, or is vocalist is your instrument, as you had said?
No, I played a little guitar in Vanderbilt, but I'm not proficient enough to, I don't feel comfortable playing, but no,
yeah.
I just sing.
I think William's got a question that kind of relates to what we're all talking about right now.
Cool. William graduated today, so what's your question?
Do you find yourself wanting to try like different sounds with like different vocal sounds for each other band?
With being in so many different bands or through the time, do you find yourself kind of changing the tone a little bit so you don't sound like the band before or anything? Or how do you guys work with that?
For me in particular, my voice is fairly recognizable. I'm not going to be able to get away from that. I sound like me. But stylistically, it was really important to be able to take the House to Glory of Vanderbilt, for instance, that had a particular feeling that's different than Apocalypse Hoboken. Apocalypse Hoboken, you know, is more aggro, and Vanderbilt was more, I wanted to, for lack of a better word, sing more. Then a band like Vice Lords was a little more shouty. Werewolves was kind of in between that. It gets a little schizophrenic after a while trying to be in, you know, 10 different bands. But if that's what you do, if you're a singer and you want to play different types of music in different bands and want to make it sound at least different, you're going to have to be able to adapt to the music. There's a band that I was in called Tongues, and I had a really hard time singing in that band because the music was so, it was hard for me to wrap my head around the music. It was more noodly, a little more metal influenced, and I never really, you know, found that comfort. So it's kind of hit or miss.
Gov, I'm going to throw you the same question, but I want to say that Brian Peterson is actually in the chat, and he is saying that Todd was correct and in your assessment of Fireside, and that he started working on shows with Dave Eves.
Dave Eves, yeah.
So the two of them started booking Fireside together. Also, Brian Peterson said in a message in the comments that you two are like his favorite Chicago musician personalities through the years. So that's a great credit. He's worked with a lot of bands, and you guys have too. Fun. So, Gov, correct me if I'm wrong, William, but he was saying you've been in so many different bands. My twist on it is, do you challenge yourself to sing different in different ones, or do you always want to set yourself up as the same type of vocalist, or do you feel you need to change it up for each band?
You know, I think it comes naturally, John. I think the music kind of makes the vocals work, in so to speak, like Engage. The vocals came out the way they did out of the passion from it. They came out the way the music sounded, just like even in Blackouts. I sound different when I sing even in Blackouts compared to singing Engage or when I sang in Ivy League did backing vocals. The current band goes for us. I think I sound completely different. I don't really necessarily try to make it different.
I can usually tell your voice, Gov, but I see what you're saying. I guess from the internal workings of yourself is you're putting yourself in a different place based on the instruments and the instrumentation of it. So it causes you to sing differently, I'd imagine.
Definitely a similarity because it is my voice. There is no changing. I can't, you know, go falsetto in one band and then, you know, sing really deep and this is how I sing this band, so I'm not sounding like that song. And you know, I'm not forcing it.
Yeah.
I'm not the intention of changing the sound.
You know, I went through both your catalogs a little bit today, and the overlaps I was trying to think, you've both been in so many different bands, and maybe we'll even talk about how many bands you think you've been in. But there does seem to be similarities in a lot of it. All of it does seem somewhat experimental in ways. Like you guys moved through the emo movement or helped start form that movement. And I guess my only question is that assessment true? It always seems you're always in bands that are trying to push things a little bit different than the main punk look of the band.
I think that the main look of the punk of the band thing is kind of just that kind of came out later. I think the punk bands before were punk bands. Like when Weasel started, you guys were just playing music and playing pop music. You know what I mean? You were playing music. You were doing what you wanted to. So I think that edge of music has always been avant-garde. And some bands go in one direction, some bands go in another direction, and other bands, they all influence each other. So like for us, for example, we get claimed to be like the start of the emo movement, but that wasn't even our intention. You know, we just were a bunch of crazy kids, like really passionate about music and just coming out about how we felt about the way the world was, the way we felt about growing up, where we were at. And we just exploded with all this energy. And it wasn't like a planned, we sat down and went, oh, I'm going to do this and do that. And there's a form that just kind of happened.
You didn't get that manual, the punk, when you were in seventh grade?
Punks in the Pit. That was a fun thing. But yeah, there's manual. I mean, we weren't like, oh, we're going to be this genre or that. Yeah. There was no genre. You know?
but you, in, I mean, you were in a band that eventually was a genre, you know? Okay. I mean, you guys were one of the first Midwestern emo bands.
Right.
That's what you ended up being called by people, you
sure.
know? The same way that Screeching Weasel was a pop-punk band, one of the purveyors of, you have 10,000 bands that sound just like your band. It's crazy.
Right. That's the
But when you're in the band, you never think that way, you know?
I guess that's my kind of a question. That's always my question with creativity, that balance between trying to do something that's unique to yourself, but also trying to emulate or you know, things that you're inspired by or even imitate. It just seems like an interesting balance. And sometimes people are thrown into what they call selling out, which I've always hated that sort of idea, because I mean, who knows if a band is selling out. If they like what they're doing, who cares if it's like well-known or not? But it's more, I can't right. believe that there actually are people. It seems weird to me that people actually do music they don't like in order to achieve some sort of fame. And that I even have a hard time believing that exists. Do you guys know what I'm saying? Like it's.
Absolutely. It doesn't make any sense to me.
I mean, it seems like some, you know, we can speculate what people think of bands. We can speculate to say that guy feels this way. He's, you know, he's trying to just do it without feeling, but who really knows? You know, you really don't know if that person's just trying to sell out, unless you're like, you know, Poison or something. But
you being in a band that was far more popular than any of the bands that I have been in, how does it feel to you back when you were playing in Weasel to play with a band that you know worships you guys or emulates the way you play music? And I mean, how does that feel to see so many different Carbon copies, whether they're good or bad? Does it start to feel weird, or do you just kind of filter it out and it doesn't affect you at all?
That's a really good question, because I think the answer is sort of like all over the spectrum. Like my positive response is that I love it. The idea of being an influential person is, I don't know, it's kind of something I think I wanted in my life. That's why I started out as a teacher and still do teach, because there's something about influencing people or helping people that really makes me feel good about myself. So I think that translates into being affected by people emulating or, you know, or liking the style that we fell onto, you know, thinking that we, you know, who created any what style, you know, basically we were just stealing Ramones type music, but adding like Judas Priest's melodic solos on top of it. You know, I mean, it wasn't, it all came from somewhere else. So part of my humility just allows me to let some of it pass over me. But my more critical, right. My more critical answer to that, Todd, is I'm often very offended by people saying they're like a Weasel influence band, but they have no heart or deepness. They basically do is take a woman's name and an adjective or an action, and they think that's a pop punk song. You know, they think that's a Weasel song, and they don't really get to the, I don't know, the depth that I think Ben writes at, you know. Or that we used to talk about, the philosophy that we used to talk about, like social politics. We were never really a governmental politic band, but I really believe that we were like a socially political band, like questioning,
absolutely
questioning who you are and the choices that you're making. And I think a lot of the bands miss that a lot of the time.
Absolutely, especially early Weasel, like the Pervo Devo 7-inch. That's a nasty little record. It's awesome. It's one of my favorites because it's so, and I mean nasty in a good way.
Yeah, I got
from
you.
From the cover to the lyrics in those songs that you were pushing something that was positive yet scared some people, and it was something that was needed at the time. And that heart, like you were talking about, is missing from a lot of the bands that emulate what's considered a Screeching Weasel type sound. And that's what I loved about your band in particular in the beginning also was I can remember back in the early shows when you guys would end with "I Want to Be Naked." Every time that we would go to a show, me and all my friends, we knew at the end of every show there would be this amount of freedom that we didn't have anywhere else other than going to a Weasel show, and where all of our friends, regardless of any type of weird fights that happened in the pit previous in the show, everyone at that moment was having fun, and it wasn't of a sexual nature. It wasn't perverted. It was just, it was fun. It was kids being free. It was the epitome of youth. And it was a really special thing that you created that helped shape so many people at that time to want to create and keep that thing going. That's what makes scenes important, that as we all get older, we kind of lose touch as to what that means. You know, you become an adult and you start not so much forgetting what it means to what that word scene meant. You know what I mean? It becomes kind of a bad word as you age, or almost embarrassing. Like, oh, I'm not part of a fucking scene anymore. That's for kids, but it's not. It's actually really important, I think. And I'm on a tangent here, but
no, I really liked all you were saying. And
I've always wanted to tell you that.
Oh, thank you. We actually, I want to throw this to Gub in a second, but I'll respond by that. Me and Ben actually had a disagreement later on in like 96 or 95, right before we recorded Bark Like a Dog. We went to Lookout Records in California and tried to put it out there, and then we went to Fat instead. But they just got done doing the Riverdales, and I wasn't in that. And Ben said something in this meeting that we were all going to, where we're going to carry on the Riverdales thing with all jeans and leather jackets. And I just immediately, like, all my radars went off, you know, like all my, like, I said, no, I never agreed to that. I will never do that. I don't wear leather jackets. I don't wear jeans. I think we started this whole band on the idea that we do whatever the fuck we want. And that's the way I'm going to be in this band until I'm, you know, not. So, I appreciate people sort of grabbing onto that aspect of the band that I feel like it allowed people to be their weird selves. Like, you meet so many bizarre fucking amazing people in the punk scene, especially in the 80s and 90s. I mean, it just seemed more open to accepting like all different weird styles, just odd people. And I love that. I still search it out. Like whenever I go to any punk show or anywhere, any puncher, I still look for those odd people, you know?
Absolutely.
Gub, so, you had a big influence. Oh, I'm sorry. Well, before you go, William, I want Gub to just respond a little bit to this, because I know you also, with whether it's you accept that or not, we sometimes talk about the emo sort of influence and also the inspiration you had. But how do you feel about what me and Todd were just talking about? I just want to throw it to you for a moment, Gub.
I completely agree with what you guys are talking about. I don't know much more to say about it. I mean, I think that the heart and soul of a band's egg are emulating more, seems very poshed and polished.
Gub, we're losing a little bit of your voice, but I think you said about polished and forced. A lot of the music comes off that way.
Exactly.
Yeah, I wonder if that's just sometimes I think, is it just because I'm old and I don't understand what they're doing now? I mean, do you think part of that plays into that?
Some of it does, but I do think that.
I think it has a lot to do
when.
Well, you're both speaking at once, so I'm going to go to Todd for a moment, then back to you, Gub.
Let Gub finish his thought.
Okay, go ahead, Gub.
I have no thought. It's gone.
The polished thing, I think what, at least for me personally, I have to keep my ear to the ground to continually hear the music that is pushing boundaries. Because if you let yourself kind of get stuck in a rut, you know, listening to whatever, you have to search for things the same way that we searched for things back when we were teenagers, finding good music and, you know, going in the back of Maximum Rock and Roll and, you know, circling the records in the record review section that you think looks cool for whatever reason. It's something that you just stop doing for whatever reason. There's so many bands that aren't polished and, you know, however you want to call it, there still is an underground. It's a little harder to find now, I think. It used to be, it used to feel like it was hard to find without the internet, but it's all right there now. And you have to, there's so much of it. I have a 16-year-old daughter right now. We raised her in what we thought was the best setting for a child to grow up creatively and be around good music and creative people. And she's the biggest fucking bitch. No, she, she's into, she's into rap and, things that are, you know, popular for her. And I respect that. And I'm not going to take that away from her. You know, I'm not going to be like, you like shitty music and rap music sucks nowadays. You should listen to De La Soul. And what she likes is what works for her. And she feels that she is part of an underground. It's her underground and it is there. It's my perception of it is so different. All of our perception of what comes from the heart is different, but it still comes from the heart. Even though we might see it as being polished, it's the new way things are done. At least that's my feeling on it. I mean, sure, there's bullshit music, but in terms of a youth culture, things have changed, and you know, you're gonna have nasty, dirty sounding music and music that comes from the heart, and then there's gonna be this new thing that we're not gonna get maybe the first time around, but I think we eventually will get it because we're really fucking smart guys, you know.
Well, I'm gonna respond. I think to maybe what Gub is thinking, or my addition to that is the difference in what you're saying, which I agree with Todd, is that maybe what we're reacting a little bit to is being from a scene where we were doing what wasn't really acceptable at the time. And the fact that it became acceptable is kind of what I react to sometimes, of thinking polished, or it's like our own scene became that polished thing. But I do believe what you're saying, Todd. I've always believed that the underground is always there. It's just that we're not a part of it as much anymore. So it's harder to have a grasp of it.
You summed it up for me, John, in better words than I came up with. And I completely agree with you, Todd. I have a story to reflect that concept, just about relevance of music, not to be like boasting of myself or any of the bands I've done. But when Captain Jazz brought us back out after we did our reunion shows for Gage, we played out in Philadelphia. And I remember playing the show, we were opening up for them. You know, they used to open up for us back in the day, and now we're opening up for them, which is cool because it's not an egotistical party. It's all about playing music and having a good time. But there was a 9-year-old kid that came up to me after the show and was like, "You guys are amazing." And at that point, all I could think of was, you could be my grandkid. And there's still some relevance of what you were trying to say when you were 20 years old or 19 or 18, and it's still affecting these kids in a way that they get inspired and they want to write music and they want to be a part of something more than just everyday kid that wants to, you know, do whatever they're doing.
Even more amazing, I think kids for the most part want to see someone in their own age group playing for them. They don't want to see some 50-something guy fucking, it's just the way it is. And to have that happen is fucking amazing. And that is the power of when you know that you've done something meaningful. And it kind of circles to back what John was saying. I think all of us were in bands kind of for the same reason. We were those kids that the kids finding a local band that we really liked and that meant something to us. And all we ever wanted to do was kind of do the same thing to make that some other kid somewhere pick up our record and say, you know, I want to do this. I want to start a band and, you know, start playing in his basement. And it's such an easy thing to do that not enough people do, because as easy as it is, it's hard. It takes determination and heart. It's just not, it has more to do, I think, with heart and determination than it does with lessons. Did either of you guys take any type of music lessons before you were in bands or after you had played?
I had one guitar lesson, and then my teacher just tried to teach me Steely Dan stuff and things like that. So I quit.
My guitar lessons were watching other bands play. Always inspired. Yeah. Nine Remarks, great punk band from Downers Grove in the early. I went to the same place, you know, Protagonist from Naperville. You know, just seeing bands and watching them play, that's how I really got inspired.
Yeah.
I mean, even inspired at a younger age of like 7 and 8, but you know, my tastes were like Kiss and Bee Gees, Black Sabbath.
Yeah.
You know, it was all over the spectrum.
Yeah, me and Ben sort of learned how to play together, like in the band, Screeching Weasel. But I don't think I really became a guitarist until Even in Blackouts, where I started studying like music theory and chords, different chords, because I wanted it to be acoustic where you can hear all the strings more. So I definitely had to learn. And we had a great vocalist, Liz, who is amazing, like choir trained vocalist. So it sort of challenges me and Gub both to keep learning, you know, because to keep her interested. I want to throw this back to William, because he did have a question, but also I think a lot of what we're saying is relevant since he is sort of the younger generation. And one of the reasons me and Bill continued doing this live thing is William seemed very interested in it. And we seemed to have some information to impart to him. And I was learning a lot from listening to him too. So William, do you want to ask a question, or do you want to respond to what me, Todd, and Gubba were talking about?
I actually have a kind of interesting question. So who influenced you the most, and where did it all start?
And where did it all start? I think it's a little vague question, but I like it being vague so we can answer how we want. Todd, what's your response to that?
In terms of influences, I was in the situation that I got to sing for the band that I loved. I mean, I was in high school with the original singer of Apocalypse Hoboken. So I thought Ted was the shit. He was in my art class, and he would give me Apocalypse Hoboken practice tapes, you know, when I think I was a freshman in high school. So I tried to emulate the way Ted sang. But as I got older, it became important for me to, without having to think I was developing my own style, it became important for me to come into my own. So I don't know if I really looked up to anybody, to be honest with you, who I felt gave me inspiration. There's many things that I'm inspired by, but as for the music that I wanted to create, I wanted it to be mine, and I took what I liked and ran with that, but nothing really I wanted to emulate or sound like, if that makes any sense.
No, you didn't want to be like a karaoke singer, where everybody's trying to be that one singer to sing the song the correct way. So William, you know, you've done guitar lessons, you've done vocal lessons, and I think he's at that point going into high school where guys don't tape trade no more. They don't start on the bus saying, hey, you got to listen to this, check this out, because everything's Bandcamp. And I think he's just wanting to pursue music so much. I mean, how many hours a day do you put in right now?
Probably 5, 6, 7 hours a day.
5 to 7 hours a day, just on the guitar, finding his own style.
You need to sleep more, William.
Hey, I didn't sleep at all when I was that his age, I don't think. I'm sort of interested in your response to what William is saying, because you are a guitarist and vocalist. So did you practice a lot on your own? I know we didn't really have lessons, but was practice for you being in a band, or would you sit for hours and practice too?
Night and day. I would sit there and play to other songs. I would try to write my own songs when I was trying to figure out guitar. And the one thing that I noticed that helped me the most with writing at a young age was you have one thing that a guy my age doesn't have, and that's this awesome romantic energy. And something coming in called puberty, which is going to really help you write awesome songs. Really, on a spectrum, when your emotions are going all, you start coming up with really crazy and creative ideas on how to play music. You know, don't feel like it's weird when you play something, and try to record it. That's what I would do. I would try to record it on a tape cassette. Like, so we used to do a cassette. He doesn't have a tape cassette. You know, record it or some kind of thing, just, and listen to it, because that will, yourself might inspire yourself to write something else.
How many videos do you have of yourself? He's got...
So far now I've been recording, and I think I have maybe five, six, like 5 to 8 just ideas of my own music just out there.
That's great. You know, and sometimes those pieces from each different song might be better than the other songs, you know?
For me, I know I did a good job when he says it's really good.
Good critic. Your dad's always a good critic.
In all fairness, I mean, owning a record store, you question how somebody got put on an album.
You hear it all.
Like, you play something, you're just like, what fucking parent said this was a good idea for this person to continue? I mean, I'm grateful as an artist that they went out there and did everything, but as a music fan or listener, I mean, some shit's just a complete train wreck. It should just have been on a cassette tape and not rolling out with 100K behind it back in the day. You know, and it's so with him, it's like there's times where it's just like, wow, that was absolutely brutal. That sucked. And other times where it's just like, that's awesome. So I prefer just to tell him, dude, that sucked, or that was really good.
I'll make a weird reference, but whenever someone talks like this, I say the word Ratatouille, which is a Pixar movie. But one of the things I think is brilliant about this movie is it doesn't say by the end of it that anybody can do anything. That's what a lot of people take away. They take away, they think, oh, it's about just, you could, anybody can do anything. It's like, it's more specific than that. It's saying anybody should have the ability to try anything they want. But it does point out that you don't always succeed at that, that there is sort of skills that you have to nature, or that some people have inherently, that lead you in a direction. So I really like that idea, and it seems to relate to what we're saying, that it isn't just you can do anything. It's more or less you should be given the freedom to try whatever you want, but then also have the self-critical part of yourself that goes, oh, I'm not really good at that. Either I have to try harder to be good at that, or I move on to something else, you know?
I think, actually, my friend Kurt Harrison from The Usuals is on, and, you know, like, so his son has messed around with different beats and trying different things, and I know Williams wanted to, like, play with him various times to try stuff out, and, you know, I mean, that's the cool thing is when, you know, you've got dad's friends and mom's friends that have kids that are younger that want to play music. It's easy for them to jump from house to house to just go jam.
I'm going to bring Todd back in here. I don't really know how to answer this because my past memories are always so sort of just thrown all over. But this person, Cody Osborne, here's a long question, but here it is, Todd. Was there any interactions back in the day between SW and Apocalypse Hoboken? Did you guys think about each other's bands in a positive or negative way? People used to say Cool Kids was about Southside bands like AH and Oblivion. Any truth? Was there any sort of rivalry? And my only thoughts was, I remember back in the Dirty Nelly days that this, I thought this was Apocalypse Hoboken, but you weren't in the band then. I think it had a dramatic change when you sort of became the front man. But there just, I think there was a little rivalry in that we can only do so many shows a week. And I think Apocalypse Hoboken wanted to play more often than we were able to fit them into the schedule, and it came like a little bit of a strife in the beginning. But after that, I don't think there's anything. Once you were in the band, I really enjoyed watching you in the band. So
there was no rivalry with Hoboken and Screeching Weasel, but your band was thought of quite a bit for coming from me, because I was a fan of the band. So my perception of things, whether when Weasel got bigger and bigger, a lot of us felt like something was getting taken away from us. The shows got bigger, So more people were coming, and it was a different type of person that was coming. But it wasn't just happening to you guys. It was happening to everybody. But I say this in terms of a band that we liked. And then you guys had the added bonus of having Ben Weasel as a frontman. So that added an element outside of the band being the band. You also had the band and Ben Weasel. And Ben caused a lot of issues with people. It's not so much Screeching Weasel. A lot of things got thrown on the band when in essence it was because of somebody else's big mouth. I wrote a song called Pop Goes the Weasel. And that song wasn't about you, the band, but it was about Ben Weasel. And it referenced Ben Weasel. One of the lyrics was, Ben is tired, it's time to go home now. That's the only type of like interplay that the band had with Hoboken. But in terms of the band having, your band was an important band to a lot of local bands that were part of what was considered your, you know, we were all part of the same scene. Mm. So like bands like the Boll Weevils and 88 Fingers Louie, and we all had these ideas of what Ben was like, and they probably weren't true. They probably weren't real. It was all based on rumor and hearsay. And it's a weird thing because you guys became like this mythic creature where the personality became lost in the myth. When the band was around earlier, it seemed like it was everybody's band. And then it turned into something else. And the crowds got bigger and bigger and the shows got shittier and shittier. And it was just an inevitable process of being.
I know that's the one thing about being older now is you can sort of, if you're brave enough, you can face the other people that you may have had disagreements with and look at it in a rational way. I really like what you're saying, Todd. I do feel like we were pretty nasty sometimes to our own scene. But I don't know, it really just seemed like it was a growing personality in Ben that the band became more and more about that antagonism. And at first he didn't like it. He just had this anxiety that would come off on stage. If anybody, I think how I pictured it was that noise in the audience was magnified in his head. Like if someone said something, he had to react to it. Like our 20-minute set would turn into an hour and a half because his anxiety had to like face this person in the audience. And I think it became such a big part of the band that he started competing with himself to be as outrageous and nasty as he could be. And I think over the years, it became less and less about a band and more about that. And it shows in the writing too. It became more Ben introspective and less about the scene and the social movements.
Absolutely. And that's not a bad thing and it's not a good thing. It's just the route the band took. I mean, it's the way things were. And Ben has a strong personality and it came out in strange ways sometimes. A show that sticks out in my mind was the Tony Brummel show. I believe it was it one of your breakup shows or something where Tony Brummel started a big fight with Ben and the show got stopped and it was a crazy thing that ended up turning into all sorts of rumors and myths started about that particular McGregor show. And it was that type of thing that started happening more and more because people were expecting it to happen. Who's Ben going to piss off today? Who's he going to fight with today? It took away from the music eventually because it turns into a circus. I got to experience that with Hoboken where people started to want, oh, Todd's going to, he's going to do this. He's going to do that. Todd's going to like it if I fucking say fuck you to him the entire night and stick my middle finger up in his face the whole time that he's playing. I mean, people get a feeling, a false perception of who you are because it's their idea. It's what they love about the band. And sometimes it eventually hurts a band when you have that thing going. I mean, like Gub, I'm sure people were like crying at Gage shows a lot, weeping. And
that's all they do. No, because, you know, we were just the emo things of labeling, but we were post-hardcore kids, you know? That was more of a hardcore punk rock band that just went into a different direction. Kids were losing their minds. We were losing our minds. The energy was so ecstatic and electrifying that people were screaming, going insane. And, you know, it was really interesting to see people. Campbell, it was almost like a therapy session. People was like, thanks, man. That was great. Like, now I can finish my, you know, my classes in, you know, senior year.
You guys were extremely cathartic as a band live. I mean, watching you and Kevin and Neil and Ryan was, it was fucking amazing. Always.
Thanks, man. You know, the weird thing about that band was it was writing wise, it was rarely planned out. I remember one day we wrote 5 songs in one day on the spot playing together. Came out with 5 songs on the spot and just wrote it. You know, it was one of those things where that band was just very energetic. To write songs to get on the spot was, I have this idea, put these lyrics together with this, let's make a bridge here. Things just kind of happen. Very unusual.
We're going to have to wrap it up in about like 5 or 10 minutes. This has been really great, guys. I could talk all day with you guys, but I want to try to bring it to a close. But you guys have been in so many different bands. I posted some of your bands on my page today, so I advise all of the audience to dig in. If you're, you know, you have the internet now, so dig into all that. But I want to bring a little bit to William, and this question that Brian Kelly asked in the chat here is, what do kids have to do to rebel against parents who were or are punks? First, I responded to that question like, I didn't grow up trying to rebel. I was trying to fit in. I was just a fucking weirdo. So I realized it was hard. I was inevitably never going to be able to just fit in. So I'm really interested in that idea of rebellion and what that means to you, William. Like, do you feel the need to rebel against your father? And you can be honest. I mean, are there aspects of him you don't want? Is there something that you feel needs to be rebelling in order for you to be unique?
No, honestly, I just listen, like, all of the punk music I listen to that at school, and I enjoy listening to it. And then you have that kid sitting right next to you that's just giving you the look, telling you to turn it off, and you say no, and they want to start something, but you're just listening to something that makes you happy, and just you enjoy it.
Right, so it's almost like seeing it's a rebellion from the outside, but inside, William, I think you're kind of saying what I was saying, where you just found something you liked. You're just an odd kid that's really talented, and you found something interesting to you, and your dad sort of helped you along the way and opened up some of those. I didn't have the rebellion either, but I understand that it's a big part of growing up, but I was trying to keep my family together. So, Gov or Todd, how do you respond to that? What is your opinion on rebellion, and did you feel that as a punk?
I'll go first. I mean, I really didn't feel rebellion towards my family. I always felt like no one would ever listen to anything I had to say. You know, talking all the time. But truthfully, I was really mad at society. I think I was more mad at society. I think I was more mad at myself. Because, you know, I didn't grow up, you know, just a cookie cutter family and that kind of lifestyle. It was very different. And I think a lot of the pulling for me from music was the fact I was still fighting myself, fighting my demons or whatever, and that me going writing and playing music, and that's what draws me to it.
I completely understand what you're saying, Gub, and I agree. I do see that in you, and I think you've done an amazing job over the years. Todd, what's your thoughts on that?
I think rebellion is important, but I came from a super Christian family that was insane. But that was neither here nor there. My rebellion can be rebelling yourself. I mean, it's important, I think, to creativity because it keeps it fresh. And, man, I don't know. I'm turning into a prune right now. So
let's squeeze you.
I know. It just seems more to me about just trying to have a voice in the world. And I think there's just some of those personalities are going to find that no matter what they have to do. And like for me, it wasn't, I guess my rebellion was to not rebel against my family. And that was kind of odd to do at the time, especially in the punk scene. You were in such a, sounds like a situation, Todd, where you weren't as Christian as your upbringing. Is that what you're saying a little bit?
There was a lot of friction.
Right. So you had that built in response to rebel. That's pretty like. Almost a very extroverted rebellion against that sort of concept. I just think that's interesting. Yeah. I guess it's all in us. It's just, I never really see it as rebellion. I just see it as trying to just find your way. Like
overall, I mean, are you rebelling to be a follower? Or are you rebelling to be a leader in something that you believed in? And if anything, you know, throughout this, it's, if William wants to rebel and hey, fuck you, dad, and blah, 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 blah. You know, as long as he has leadership behind it and he's executing his idea and wanting to follow through with it and, you know, justify things and not just saying it to say it because he hears it in a song, but actually is educated and passionate about it and all that. It's encouraging because you want your child to be able to think on their own and lead on their own and do things on their own. And that's one thing I kind of like about the friends and the family that we hang around with and whatnot. It's encouraging. It's like, hey, all these people that we've been on the show with, every one of you has, you know, faced different parts of your life, but haven't given up and just keep pushing and pushing and pushing. And I think that's the most important thing is William doesn't see failure. He sees everybody go through all their shit in life and they're still pushing through it.
Yeah, sure. Someone will, you know, mess up here and there, but it doesn't mean that they have to give up. They'll keep on pushing and pushing until they get to the top of the mountain. And once when they reach there, you know, they look back and they're like, wow.
But, or they jump off.
I remember being younger and the communication with parents was a lot different than it seems to be now. Parents and kids talk a little more openly about things and there's a lot more compassion and emotion involved in the communication and more logical communication than I think when we were growing up. Maybe it's just the 70s and everyone's high, but I think it's a lot different now for kids growing up because they have that with kids. You feel that way, one, that you have a really good connection with your dad?
Yeah.
That's awesome.
I think that has a lot to do with our generation raising this new generation. I really do. I think we're going to have a good crop of adults.
With what I used to be able to get away with and you guys were able to get away with growing up and everything, you may have had a target on your back just because you were youth and doing something different. But I think now in today's society, there's more people trying to get to him to find out what I'm doing wrong to stir more of the pot. So I think you wind up with more of a parent-child trust than anything nowadays because they're able to see just all the wickedness that's in the world right now. You know, it's he's opinionated, and I encourage him to be as opinionated as possible.
You better. He's a good kid.
He is.
Obviously, I need to write a essay on rebellion because I got so many thoughts about it. But my last one, I just want to say, I know we've sort of moved on, but my last thing to clarify is I think it's a misunderstanding of what rebellion is because I think I saw a lot happening. When I saw people rebelling against their parents, there was almost like a coded way that they had to do that. Like, You couldn't agree with anything your parents agreed with, even if you agreed with them. You know what I'm saying? Like, rebellion took on this thing that was just anti instead of finding your own way. I think that's kind of my sort of dissertation against the idea of rebellion is that I think it's just often misunderstood. Why does having to be punk mean you kick over that garbage can late at night after you get out of, you know, that metro, you know, what is that? I mean, rebellion is just misunderstood. I think that's sort of my standing on my soapbox understanding of rebellion. So let's wrap it up. Todd, you look like you're about to say something.
I still rebel. And the whole, when I would tell myself before I had kids, I'm going to do everything opposite of what my parents did in raising a kid. So that was still being rebellious. It's a multifaceted word and it has many meanings. And that's why I think rebellion can be positive. And it's an important thing. It really depends on what definition you're using.
Yeah. No, I like that we slightly disagree about it because
you guys should stop rebelling against each other.
Keeps us alive. All right, boys, I'm gonna wrap this up. I have to start my day, and you guys are ending your nights. So thanks so much for participating. If you have a moment, sometimes I like to, if you go into the comments on the Facebook page, and if someone asks a question we didn't get to and you're interested in it, just take a look and give some answers. So that sort of lives on after we go live. And I'll sort of put some posts in there too and some links. Any last words from William, Bill?
No. Besides, this was the best graduation day ever.
He got spoiled today. So, you know, for somebody complaining about rap, he had a hip-hop artist come out and go a cappella almost on the street for him. But, so,
Yeah, I think we talked we touched on hip hop before, and I always bring up that movie Ghost Dog, which I think has some of the most amazing music, and that's the one that sort of made me turn the corner on that genre, and the difference between rap and hip hop in some ways. One is more melodic than the other, so it's just another beast that has thousands of different tentacles and arms, you know, that I can't possibly ever learn about. So I try to keep at least a little bit of an open mind about it.
You know, it's all about expression, and William's going to learn how to express himself from my actions, and Cooper's going to learn how to express himself from my actions and Jenny's actions and William's actions. And at the end of the day, it's, you know, how do we come and get the point across? So it doesn't matter if it's rap or, you know, whatever. I mean, even classical can be very, have a lot of expression, a lot of hatred, a lot of anger and everything put out there if you sat and listened to it. So I encourage everybody, you know, just go out and do your fucking thing and be happy when you do it. Don't worry about what somebody like myself thinks. Just fucking own it. And that's what I hope he does growing up, is just owns everything that he does.
It was a pleasure to have you all here. Todd in your tub, Gub in your wall.
Surprise, Todd hasn't died yet. Drop a lamp in the tub.
Yeah. Loves electricity.
All right, gang, I'm going to sign this off. So thanks, everyone, for listening to us talk and chatting in the room there. There's a lot of chatting going on today, so I think they were corresponding amongst themselves. So that's good. Yeah, I like to see that, too. Yeah. We got Kyle Kinane in the room, one of my favorite stand-up comedians. He's in there.
Right on.
Brian Peterson. So, all right, guys. Thanks a lot. Have a good night. Take care of yourselves. Bye-bye.
Right now, you're listening to Pulling Worms Apart, which is from Apocalypse Hoboken's album, House of the Rising Son of a Bitch. Thank you for listening to episode 46 of Jughead's Basement with Gub Scott Conway and Todd Pott. Up next, well, let me know which quarantine episode feels right to turn into a podcast with audio. I have also once again began editing the Smoking Popes episode. It will be an epic podcast once and if I ever get it done. So, stay connected, stay alive, and be good to each other.